Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week, wherever you are listening. Thank you so much for listening to this season of the Griefcast. It is our 10th season. Still a bit staggered by that. Also, in other news, I've been saying it a lot recently, but I just want you to know, I have written a book. It's coming out January 17th, and you can pre-order it now. It's called You Are Not Alone. It's everything I've learned from the podcast, talking to all these amazing people for the past 6 years, and my own experience as well. And it's so helpful if you think you're going to buy the book anyway. If you do a pre-order, it really is an amazing way to support an author. If you've done so already, thank you so much. This week, I'm talking to the incredible writer and poet Yomi Shode. Yomi is an award-winning Nigerian-British writer. He was a recipient of the 2019 Jerwood Poetry Fellowship, and he's also the author of Mannerism, an incredible, incredible book of poetry that is available to buy now. Yomi came in to talk to me about Big Mummy, who is his grandma's sister and was a hugely important influence on his life. So, Yomi, who are we remembering today?
Oh, man. So, I, do you know what it is? I think because of the weight of the title of the podcast, it's kind of like it had me thinking in so many ways. So today, I think I'm thinking about my big mummy for sure. Mm-hmm. It'll be good to talk about her as well as my family. But oddly, I'm also think in the lead up to, just in the lead up to Mannerism entering the world. Mm-hmm. People kind of having this book in their hands. I'm thinking about friends that I would have wanted to share that with, who were not talking anymore, or we've just kind of grown distant, or you know, because there's this kind of thought I've always had, however kind of like immature of me or naive or whatever, that you grow old with your friends. You see what I mean? It's almost like, especially because of the way I arrived in England, I hold so much pressure. Like there's a care that I hold to any friends I make because I arrived in England with just my mum. The idea of building anything outside of my relationship with my mom
was really important, right?
It's important, like, so the thought of just like of losing that is so weird for me. So especially at this kind of milestone, I'm like, I would have loved to share this moment with some people, and the reality of that not necessarily happening, because that's just the ways of life. Like, see, you have friends you fall out with friends, ex wife. Do you know what I mean? It's, that kind of thing is a bit of like a hit to the system in a way, because it ideally wouldn't be something I would have wanted. But here we are, you know?
How old were you when you came to England?
I would say roughly between 8 and 9. Right. My mum would try to tell me younger. But I feel like it was that. And I didn't necessarily have much of an understanding as to the landscape I was in.
Mm.
There is this kind of like, call it a myth or some kind of fable of like when you arrive when you arrive on like foreign land, so to speak, it's like paved with gold. It's got all of these things and blah, 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 blah. Mate, I came into snow. Yeah, I came into I came into absolute freezing.
Oh my God.
And the thing is, I was more like, what's about to happen? My mum was probably more shocked than I was, but I was just like, oh, what is going on? Because it was my first kind of, I didn't know what snow was. I had no idea what snow was. So a lot of firsts was happening. Do you see what I mean? So yeah.
Oh my goodness. So with those friends and with the book coming out, what's that been like for you? Have you felt like the need to reach out to them at all? Or have you accepted that like, not everyone feels the, because it sounds similar. I find it very hard to let people go because of what happened with my dad. I find it really hard to let friends go, and I will often tolerate behavior that perhaps I shouldn't I find it really hard to let people go. And I wonder if that's again related to like early loss, like I guess you moving and leaving like a whole life. Like, do you feel like it's hard to let, because you're like, well, when will it come back?
Do you know what it is? This kind of, this thought process, it didn't really hit me until like last year, where I've realized that, oh, what is it with, there are some people that potentially I know are not necessarily the, like I had fallouts and all that stuff, but there was still this urgency to still want them around. And I had to question why that was. And the thing is, I had to now go back and to be like, oh, this is probably why you're still going through a sense of longing and not wanting to let go, because purely this what grief is for you is something that you'd want to make it work. I would always want to make it work. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I would always want to make it work, even at the detriment of myself. I would always want to make it work.
Yeah.
And the you know, it sounds so silly, but what I did not want to be was mean. I did not want to be a mean person. And the whole idea of, oh, I'm just going to close the chapter on this because it's doing me harm. Or I'm going to close the chapter on this because it's not reciprocal. I felt bad for that.
Yeah.
I felt like I shouldn't be doing that.
Mm.
But then at the same time, I had to think about my own mental health. I had to think about my own well-being and what I'm putting myself through. Essentially, the idea of prioritizing yourself is one of the hardest things to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do it easy.
Yeah.
Some people are like, I prioritize me.
No worries. Well,
worries. No worries whatsoever. Whereas with me, it's very hard for me to prioritize myself.
Mm.
I always, for the most part, put a lot of people first. Right? To my own detriment sometimes. So what I'm finding myself doing is trying to find ways to prioritize myself, but at the same time, how guilty I feel when I do that sometimes.
I definitely relate to that. And I think what you're talking about is sometimes the grief you have around relationships, especially friendships, that because someone has not put you first, or, you know, it's come to an end, or it just is what it is, but you still get that sadness that you can't, like you said, show them a thing, and you can't go back in time and be like, oh, I wish I could show you this thing when we were friends and it was fine, because now we're kind of not fine and all this stuff has happened, and sort of like silent, weird arguments that we both haven't acknowledged.
Yeah.
But they're just there. And you sort of went, I just wish I could clear the deck for a second and show you a thing I know you'd appreciate, and then go back to, okay, but we're not really talking because, it doesn't really work out between us.
100%. And I guess it's a lot of them things. And, you know, it was a very visceral feeling when I experienced what happens when I subconsciously prioritize myself to a certain degree. So when we found out about my big mummy's cancer, my grandaunt, and I had this conversation with my cousin, and I was like, But you've known she's had this cancer. She told you. We've seen each other within that time, and you didn't feel to say anything. And I was so angry. I was so angry. Because for me, I was like, oh, I'm the eldest of the younger generation. I kind of should know what's going on within the family. I know that you lot don't probably want to talk to the old folks, but I'm kind of cool. So yeah, you can talk to me type thing, right? I'm kind of like, so when I didn't necessarily hear anything until like the very last moment, and I said, you should have told me. And he came off the phone, and then he called me back, and he called me about an hour later. And he said, I didn't tell you because you haven't been around. And that was such a gut punch.
Yeah.
It was such a gut punch because I felt like I have been around. You see what I mean? I felt like I've been present, but really and truly I've been present online on socials. I haven't done that thing of calling to see how are you. And I wondered whether, had I done that, would he have told me sooner? So there was a huge guilt that I felt for the 2 years that none of the family members knew about this situation. He was taking her to each appointment. He was dealing with everything, and he had to deal with the burden of all of that at quite a young age.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, just to go back a sec. So Big Mummy is what you called your grandma, which is an amazing name.
So Big Mummy is my grandma's. So we call her my grandma's sister.
Okay.
So I was like really stuck. I'm just like, what do you call your grandma's sister? Like, what do you call your grandma's sister type thing? And I was like really like, oh. So for the most part, if we kind of put like a term on it, it would be like a grand aunt. But culturally, we just be like, oh, that's just Big Mummy. That's just what we just call it, Big Mummy.
I love it's
just,
that, Big Mummy. Yeah,
it's
a
just,
nice
it's
name.
Just, it's just what it is. It's just, that's just Big Mummy. Do you know what I mean?
So she was your grandma's sister, officially.
Yeah, yeah.
And so was she living here in England?
Yeah, right. She was here. She was working in the health service. She was very much into her faith.
Mm.
She was a very kind, generous lady. Yeah, man, quite regal in her position. And, you know, I mean, you couldn't necessarily get the most out of her. But whenever she laughed, you knew that it was definitely felt. Do you see what I mean? It was definitely something. It was definitely something that she genuinely wanted to do. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But she's very reserved, quite quiet. She wouldn't be the loudest person in the room. Do you see what I mean? But she's consistent. Yeah. She's very observant, you know? That was her.
And when did she pass away?
So she passed on December 4th, 2019, my birthday.
Oh my goodness, on your actual birthday?
Yeah, on my actual birthday. On my actual birthday. It was tough. It was absolutely tough because, you know, interestingly, I, in a weird way, the night before, I called it. I was talking to my mum, was on her way back from the hospice. And I said, no, I have this feeling. And my mum just being like reassured. My mum's just like, no. It's not going to be. So on the morning of when I received the call, I wondered whether she knew deep down that it might just happen on that day. But she never said anything just to protect me. You know, mums and parents will want to protect you and everything. So the morning when she actually did call me to tell me, she was just sounding so sad. She just sounded so sad. You see what I mean? But at the same time, she wasn't there to necessarily protect me. And I felt sad because I wasn't there to protect my cousin who was with her.
Oh, I see. So the cousin who'd been taking her to the appointments and kind
her son. Her son. So he was there with her. And I had said the night before, tomorrow, I'm going to see you first thing. And then when the news came that she passed, I immediately slept through the night, right? So I woke up to the phone call from my mum. And then I checked my phone and he texted me not long after she died. But I was well and truly sleeping. So then when I saw the message, I was just like, damn. I wasn't there for you again. So it was almost like, you know, it took me back to when he said you haven't been around. And then I was just like, I'd done everything from that point to be around. And I was working off of a lot of guilt in just being around because I felt like I wasn't present enough. And then when she passed, to read that message, and it wasn't a message to be like, oh, why are you not here type thing. It was just this message to just be like, she's gone, blah, blah, blah. But I took that as I wasn't there for you.
Yeah.
So I mean, I wasn't there for you to support you in this point in time. Of course, he was like, you've been supporting me. You've been supporting me from the moment that you found out and everything, but I always felt like I needed to be doing more at that point in time as well. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it's really hard. And I think, especially when you're, you know, there's like the epicenter, isn't there, of like the person who is ill and their immediate family, and then the other family surrounding them as a circle. I think you always feel like you could have done more, could have, you know, especially when someone is very sick. And that's such a normal human thing to just, you know, be sleeping and not wake up to a text. Like, 100%. That's so normal. Like, and I think we just, yeah, you know, I wonder also as well, like when he said you weren't around, like he must have been going through so much as well of having carried it for ages and looking after his mom. Like, you do then say things to people because you're just, you are sad and angry that this is happening. You know, that is a grief in a way as well. When I hear people say things like that, of like, do they really mean that? Or do they just mean, I don't want someone to die? Like, that's where that pain comes from. And there's nothing, unfortunately, like, you can't protect them from the person dying. But it comes with so much guilt, so much guilt. So this was 2019, did you say?
Yeah, this was 2019. And, you know, what was also interesting, or what came out of the process of that in regards to grief, or the process of grieving, I felt like there was a politics of it as well, interestingly. So my mum worked nights. So she worked like from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. And through the process, when Big Mummy was still alive, she was very ill and she was very weak. So my mum would often finish work at like 8 a.m. and go over to care for her, to treat her, cook food or whatever it is. But she just worked 12 hours.
Oh my God, yeah.
So by the time she'll leave work at like 8, she'll probably get to hers, to Big Mummy's, around, I don't know, 10 something.
Oh, wow.
And then look after her, whatever it is, and she'll maybe give that about 2 hours. Really and truly, she's not leaving there until about, say, after 12, 1. And one particular time, she was really tired. And on her way there, She slipped on a leaf and she fell on the floor. And strangers, people came to help her get up and everything else like that, and blah, 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 blah. But she was tired, right? And I could see her almost getting more and more tired and deteriorating herself because she just wasn't resting.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was one particular situation where she had to leave the house early in the morning, say after like 2 a.m. or something. Because, again, Big Mummy needed to be treated. And by this time, I was getting really angry. I was getting really frustrated. Because I could just see my mum getting weaker and weaker and more tired and more tired. Because she still had to work. And what was interesting was, there's no way I could have spoken about my mum's health.
Yeah.
With my cousin.
Yeah.
Knowing that my cousin's dealing with a mother that's dying. So it's almost like, you know, how dare I discuss the state of my mum when your mum's going through this.
Yeah.
And it was tough. It was and then it just made me think about this how we enter these kind of conversations. And the last one I wanted to do was to come across as like I wasn't sensitive to the situation. By the same time, that's my mother.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Like it's
Well, you're still watching somebody give, I guess, and put them. I guess it comes back to what we're talking about prioritizing yourself. And you're watching someone not prioritize themselves.
Exactly.
And it's hard because, and that happens a lot, I think, when people are very sick and everyone is caring for them. And, you know, you often hear that, don't you, at the hospital, of like nurses being like, go home, and someone being like, no, I can't. And then being like, you're no good to them like this. Like,
exactly.
You have to rest to be able to keep caring for someone. But obviously for your mum, that must have been so hard because she must have been exhausted.
Exactly.
Yeah. But also feeling as guilty as you had been feeling of like, no, she needs me. Everything. She needs me.
And this goes back to that whole thing of prioritizing self. I was just like, if I really, really, really prioritize myself, I would be saying to you straight away, no, my mom's not going to come over there.
Because
that's my
break. She needs a break.
She needs a break. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not as easy to be like that or to do that. Do you see what I mean? And I guess those things, a lot of it plays in my mind more time. Do you see what I mean? And I think about him a lot. Even I was thinking about him yesterday since we buried Big Mommy in January 2020. Thankfully, for the most part, before everything of the pandemic kicked off, because it was a really beautiful service. 3 months later, he lost a family member on his side.
Mm.
And then a year or so later, lost another family member on his side. In fact, it was the daughter of the person that had died previously. So in the space of 2 years, in the space of 2 and a bit years, he's lost 3 people.
Mm.
And by extension, I know those 3 people,
but
it's not as deep as he knows them.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, I'll have a conversation with him tomorrow and he'll be like, oh, there's tough days, good days, I'm okay. But I'm just like, you've just experienced 3 losses of that magnitude within a space of like 2 years. Let's talk.
Yeah. And do you feel like, does your family have that openness to talk about grief and stuff like that?
No way.
I was like, yeah, what is the...
No way. The third section of mannerism goes into detail. That's it, and it's exploring the whole point in time when we found out about Big Mommy's cancer. Last year, that third section was adapted to a play at the Almeida Theatre, and it was titled And Breathe. And it wasn't until that point when my mum was invited, my auntie, my uncle was invited, my cousin was invited, and they watched this play that it opened an opportunity for us to speak about it.
Yeah.
And that was like a whole year after the funeral. We'd never spoken about it. We never sat down to actually have a conversation about it. And for me, on my side, it's a cultural thing. It's just like some things, there's just some things that you don't discuss.
Yeah.
Or that are not discussed. And I think for some reasons as well, you know, we don't talk about illnesses or sickness because you want to protect other people. You don't want them to worry about them. You don't want this person to worry too much, so you kind of keep this to yourself. Whereas there are, and I noticed it a lot within African families, more so. I can't speak too much about other communities, but I definitely know that within the African community, then illnesses or anything of the sort is stuff that's not necessarily as spoken about. And it's still something that we're unearthing a bit more as a community as to why we don't freely or openly talk about illnesses, because they could be dealt with at a very early stage, and a problem shared also is something that kind of alleviates a lot of stress. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, we didn't talk about it until the play came out.
So how was that? Like, you've written a play about this intense experience and they watch it and they come out like, were you, God, you must have, did you feel nervous as they went in to watch
it? I was nervous. Oh my God, I was so nervous, because it's almost like you're putting your dirty laundry out there.
Yeah.
Like, you have to kind of see it as like, my mom's like, what do you mean you're writing? What do you mean you've got, talking about our family?
Yeah.
Am I in it? What do you mean someone's playing me?
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. What do you mean someone's playing me? And they better do a good job. I was just like, it's so funny. So, but it was the best thing that could have happened. And I think, you know, sometimes my family and my friends, for the most part, they worry because I'm a writer and because I get quite personal. They'll be wondering if they end up in a poem or something or a play at some point soon. And I'm like, even if you do end up in a poem or something, I'm not going to like say your name.
I might
describe parts of you, you know, that it's you. But I think part of it is part my purpose as well, to look at this in a way to be like, if we're not going to talk about this on a face-to-face, then how else can I explore it as a writer to ensure that we do get to discussing to a certain degree. And I'm glad that we have.
Yeah.
Especially with my cousin, I think before we started rehearsal, oh man. So I wrote this, it's a sequence of poems. And when she died, I didn't know how to speak to anybody.
Mm.
I just wasn't talking. And then about 2 weeks later, I went to my writing space and I wrote the entire section.
Wow.
I wrote the entire section. It's almost like it was burning in me to just, it was boiling, bubbling in me to write. So I got in there about after 9 and then I wrote the entire section in about 12 hours.
Wow.
And for a year, I did not share this with my cousin. Mm. I didn't know how to.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? I was just like, I've just written this entire thing that's addressing you primarily. But it's addressing you, but it's looking at the whole circle. It's looking at the whole situation, but I'm addressing you. And I just don't know how to share it. And then it was my agent was like, oh, this reads like it could be a play. Oh, we can make a play out of it. I was like, whoa.
I'm going to have to talk to someone.
You're doing a bit too much right now. What do you mean a play? And she was like, no, it can really be something. And I think those things was like a sign for me to be like, oh, you need to speak with him now. You need to speak with him. Not because this is going to be a play, but the reality is this is going to be in the book somehow.
Mm.
And I've been talking to him about it every now and then. And then he messaged me one day and he was just like, so when am I going to read this? And I was like, wow, everything seems to be falling in place. And I said, okay, let's read it. I'm gonna come to you next week Saturday and we're gonna sit down and we're gonna read it.
What was that like?
Oh, it's freaky, man. It was so weird. I recorded the whole conversation. I recorded the whole, I think I was there for about two, three hours. And I read each poem to him. We got into a discussion, we took a break, got some drinks, came back. I carried on reading the poems and we spoke about every situation.
Wow.
And I wish we'd done it earlier.
Yeah. God.
I had wished we'd done it earlier.
That's incredible to me because I guess what I find really interesting as a writer is that there was this need to express something, which, as you said, like within that, whether it's culturally or your family, you felt you couldn't. And so it got put into this other place, you know, in a way that sometimes if you're not a writer, people might just carry that, you know, they just carry it with them of like all the things I wish I'd said. But because you're a writer, it went literally got put into a document that you could then give to him and say, this is the conversation I've been trying to have, but I don't know how to.
Do you know the thing is as well, I think there is quite, and I say this very lightly, but there's some hints of something in it that, you know, writing is still it's got this kind of narcissistic trait to it, right?
Mm,
it's almost like it's got this kind of like me type situation to it. Cool. I'm going to put that in the pocket. I'm going to pocket that for a bit. I also felt like I had to question where I was writing from.
Mm.
And when I look into this, I go back to the whole situation of the phone call when it said, I don't think you've really been around. He just said, you haven't been around to talk to.
Mm.
And I felt guilty immediately.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, am I writing all of this out of guilt?
Yeah.
Out of not being around. And then when I look back at the sequence and I read it, the first maybe 4 or 5 poems of like the sequence is born out of guilt.
Mm.
It's written out of, I'm so sorry I haven't been around. And then it travels into this next part of, oh, I've not respected you as like you being a man now.
Yeah.
I've always known you as like the boy. Like I've always known you as the kid that kind of arrived in England, didn't know what was going on. And I've kind of been there to kind of show you around or buy you some clothes and blah, 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 blah. But what I haven't done was realize that you are your own adult. You're your own individual now. Hence why you can call me back and say you haven't been around.
Yeah.
Because I in my head, I'm older than you. So in a way, you should respect me. In a way, you can't back chat like that to me or anything else like that. Like, how dare you? Do you know what I mean? So we then go into this next phase of me realizing that you are your own individual. You have your own friends. You have your own independence. You da 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 da. And I have to come to that realization that I have to respect you in a different way now.
Mm.
So it was a real journey for me to go through. Hence why it was important for me to sit with him and just have a conversation with him and just say and apologize. Do you see what I mean? Like, but for me to do that, I think writing is my go-to because conversations wasn't happening. Therapy wasn't something I was engaging in at the time. So my only outlet was to write. And which is why I'm always like, for me, this is more than just the writing isn't a hobby.
Yeah.
For me, I enjoy doing it, but sometimes it's an actual process that helps my own thinking and my way forward. Like I see it so different. I experience it so differently. It became my own kind of cathartic process to make sense of everything that was going on, you know? And that's just for one section. That's not even speaking for the majority of the book, which also explores forms of different types of grief in itself, you know?
Is there a bit from that section that you would like to read?
Yeah. So I'll read a poem. This is titled, The Text Reads. Yomi, I'm eating more than usual. I noticed it the night I ate an entire pizza by myself. Each slice asking me why or uttering must you. Their voices slowly grew muffled as I curled them upwards from the tip like Swiss rolls, marvelling at the calories in my hands. I had hardly spoken since Big Mommy's death. I needed all the distractions I could get. So there I was, putting my mouth to use. Surely, I thought, I can prove more bravery in finishing an entire pizza than I will in lifting a coffin. 5 slices in, I was finding loose bits of onion on the plate, scooping them up with my hand. 3 hours earlier, you'd called asking if I could read a poem at Big Mommy's funeral. It will be an honour, I told you. And immediately, I felt hungry, wanting food I wasn't good to eat. Is this how healing works? Nah, how can I help? 2 hours after eating the pizza, I ordered a chicken pesto panini, adding more to make it more flavoursome. Roasted peppers, caramelised onions, melted cheese, and sweet potato. I peered down at my stomach later that night, in awe of my new roundness that eclipsed my penis. I turned again, rubbing my skin clockwise with little to be proud of. Every day since we arrived home from Amsterdam, I had been haunted with the thoughts of doing more. I had been digesting my guilt. I didn't like to fail those close to me. Yomi, I'm telling you, that's a start, I suppose. I was buying my suit for the funeral soon. 3 weeks before, I had tasked myself of getting in shape in time for the ceremony. I had also ignored myself completely. I was conscious of my belt fastening tighter than hugs from mourners. I was conscious of my suit jacket wouldn't be big enough to conceal my stomach. I was conscious of the well I was thinking myself deeper into. Am I being supportive enough is what I want to ask. The weekend before the funeral, I met you and your boys at KFC. They explained the process of lifting a coffin and you laughed at the snap box I ordered to eat. Though I knew it was small, I did not tell you about the gnocchi and the pho I ate 2 hours earlier at my mum's. I was not hungry, but it was the weekend before the funeral. And whatever way you needed me, I would be there. Like when you first arrived, the black boy, too shy to eat chicken in front of me and my girl. So I ate with you and your boys that night. I ripped each wing, sucked meat off reedy bones. I carried on, feeling it sit like shrubbery in my stomach and quicksand until I could sense your banter with your mandem landing more comfortably in your body and could see in your eyes that you were okay. You were going to be okay.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Oh, yummy. That was amazing. Oh, my God. That's so good.
It's that thing of, like, I didn't know comfort eating would be...
You made me hungry. That's the other thing. I was like, God, that sounds good.
Yeah, I didn't know... Yeah, I didn't know. That's just the thing. It's almost like when you're not speaking to anybody, when you're not speaking to no one about what you're going through, it manifests itself in different ways.
Mm.
And I just, you know, it's interesting. I've never spoken about this. I guess this is what this time is here for, is how easy I felt. You know, I was just eating. And the idea that I was just eating, and I knew that what I was doing wasn't the best for me, but I needed to do it because I just needed to almost escape. But I felt uncomfortable. I felt like I was purpose. It almost, do you know what it felt like? Wow, gosh. It felt like I was almost punishing myself for not doing enough. And this is what I was doing to myself as a result of just not being around. This is what I was doing to myself as a result of agreeing to something, but also being nervous at that. This is something I was doing to myself to almost feel like I'm trying to forget it, but I'm not going to forget it because it's still there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm looking for a reason to put myself deeper into a hole. And that was hard. That was like, when I realized what was going on, immediately what came after that was, oh, I just need to hide from everybody. Because now I've put myself in a situation where physically I don't feel like I need to be in public.
Yeah.
So I need to almost now, I need to dip back. And I just need to avoid any gazes or any judgments. And then we went into a pandemic.
And the world went, okay, yeah, avoid it, like, you
avoid
have...
it. And then we went into a pandemic, and we went into a pandemic, and I'm just away from everything in that world. And I was like, wow, what's about to happen here? So it was really, that whole phase was just like, it's something I don't talk much about, but it was a darkish phase for me.
It's interesting though, isn't it? I think that you, when your cousin said that to you about not being there, it made you feel uncomfortable because it's an uncomfortable feeling, guilt. And so then you physically made yourself uncomfortable. You know, like you tried to push the feeling away, but your body went, no, now we're going to keep eating until we physically feel uncomfortable, which is how we emotionally feel. And I think that's really interesting. We don't talk about it enough. I've got a book out in January, and I talk a lot about, like, I kind of stopped eating after my dad died. I went that way because it was like this feeling of just And it wasn't, again, it was a phase. It wasn't something that took over my life. It just was, like you said, a really dark place where it was like, to me, eating was like too much. It was like, I just had so many feelings that I was like, if I just don't eat anything, then that's like one less thing I have to deal with. Yeah. And I think it's really such a, you know, as we all know, like our eating habits and our emotions are so tied in together. But I loved what you're saying of like in that poem of wanting him to feel comfortable. So eating with his friends until you see him relaxing. And it's so wrapped up in love and guilt and all of, you know, everything. It's everything.
I remember that evening so well. Mm. I felt so uncomfortable because I was stuffed.
Yeah. Literally.
Essentially, I lied to him. He was like, oh, you're hungry. I'm just like,
Yep.
I'm like, I could do, because I just had a meal with my mum's. I just literally had a meal with my mum's.
You just had mum cooking, not just even like
mum cooking.
Not just
exactly.
Oh, I had a sandwich.
I just had mum cooking, and then I went to go see him and his boys, and they're all there, they're all with the banter and everything. And he's like, "Oh, you eating?" And I just ordered this snack box. If you see the size of the snack box, he looked at me. He's just like, "Bro, like, what are you doing? Like, what's wrong with you? Do you know what I mean?" I'm like, you know. Just try, sir. You know, just eat this. Just a little bit. It's all good. Not knowing that I was absolutely dreading just opening that box, however small, because I was stuffed.
Yeah. But comparing that to the box and in your mind, the box of the coffin and stuff, like, I just think it's such an incredible poem, Yomi. And so once you read it to him, so it was after the funeral and stuff that you read it to him.
It was after the funeral.
And I just wonder, like, have you, and obviously, you know, we've had pandemic to deal with as well, like, has it changed your relationship with him in terms of that grief and your family's relationship? Do you feel like because of that writing, everyone feels a bit easier talking about it now, or is everyone still like, we don't really want to talk about it, but Yomi's written some more stuff about it?
Do you know what it is, as a it's difficult. As a family, it's difficult. Just for context, my grandma lost the same year.
Mm.
January, my grandma lost her brother.
Oh.
December, my grandma lost her sister.
Yeah.
So what this meant for my mum and her siblings was we saw how bad she reacted on one side in relation to her brother. If we now tell her about her sister.
Oh, God, yeah.
It goes back to the same thing about my mum and her health and her protection. So where I'm like, oh, are we going to tell grandma about Big Mummy? And my mum's like, boy, maybe not now. And I'm just like, but that's her sister.
Yeah.
And immediately, but she never said it, but immediately the look she gave me was, but that's my mum.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh. Politics of grief. It's the politics of grief. Mm. Right, so as a family, it's almost like we it's her death is still something that's not widely spoken of, because there are still there's still protection in place to not lose anyone else
Does your grandma know now?
To my knowledge, she is aware now.
Right. Is she in this country or is she?
No,
not?
No.
Right,
she's not,
I see.
She's not.
So it's a
but
kind of.
But you know what it is? She's always sensed that there was something up.
Going
you see
on.
What
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, to my knowledge, she knows now, but it wouldn't have been in a way that I would have wanted her to know. I would have wanted her to find out in a much calmer way. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But even at the at that time when she wasn't aware, it still felt like it was an isolated grief.
Mm.
It still felt like, you know, what would have been helpful or supportive is if there was a collective grief as a family where we all knew about it and we can call each other and we can talk. But this was very much an isolated grief.
Mm.
That meant one side of the family knew and the other side of the family didn't necessarily know. So where secrecy plays as a part of protection, it's tough. It's tough. So there wasn't really any room, and I don't even think there is still room to as a family deal with that and talk about it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is sad. But at the same time, when I play back the reasons why, I'm like, okay. It's not like I get it, but
I think you can understand something, can't you, and still not like approve of it. But you can not condemn it, because you're like, I understand, and I understand it happens, you know, in British culture as well, of like the protection of people. And you know, I've definitely heard stories of people not being told that they're properly ill, and or not telling certain family members, and you can always understand it. But I agree with you. I guess that's it, isn't it? It's like, look, we're not saying right or wrong, but the consequence of that is an isolated grief, not a collective grief. So it's like, it's up to you what you do, but it is an isolated grief. And perhaps in collective grief, you know, you said you can help each other. And that's and that's so important with grief, to have that support. As you're, you know, we come back to what your cousin said, like someone being around, like, you know, they're just going to be there. They're not going to, you're not going to have to call them and remind them. They're just going to turn up. Like that feeling of support is how we get through these difficult times, these traumatic times. Is like, I just know they, like, I'll, the doorbell will ring. They'll just be there. I don't need to send that message out. Please come and help me. And that collective grief can be, it's obviously still sad, but to have that support can be hugely, hugely important.
Yeah, and you know, like, I think the last 2 years for me has been a bit of a wake up when I consider loss, because loss for me for a certain a long time, I've just looked at loss as just death.
Yeah.
I've looked at loss as just death. I've never considered loss in relation to relationships, in relation to friendships, and I've never considered mourning what could have been. Like, there are elements of Big Mummy's death that I'm just like, I could have done with an auntie to speak to, and there's a loss in that based on protection.
Do you see what I mean?
There's a loss in me being close. And the thing is, the interesting thing with death is like, it does build relationships more. It builds closeness in such a way. So even if I was to consider Big Mummy's death as a genesis for the families, all of us to connect a lot closer, or friendships to kind of, you know, going back to the earlier point that I first raised in terms of, oh, Yomi just experienced this. I know that we haven't spoken in a while. Let me just connect and just see how things are. Those moments, it kind of builds great points, a genesis almost to start over. To kind of consider what life is going forward. And when I think about loss, I kind of feel like those things spring to mind. I wouldn't be using terms of isolated grief. I wouldn't necessarily have known what that would have been unless I felt it, unless it was something I experienced. So for me, I kind of look at loss now, and there are all these different strands. You know, there's different strands of tears. The kind of cry you cry. Do you see what I mean? It's almost like there are these different strands of loss that has since grown to be a great thing for me.
They call them that in grief. They call it secondary losses. So it is that thing of like, you're grieving, oh, the person's not here, but then you can grieve something like, oh, that means we have to sell the house, or that means that I fell out with my sister about this thing, or that means that I can't have the job that I want anymore because now I have to go and care. Like, it's these other, like you said, the next strata down of grief. And I think sometimes we dismiss it slightly, of like, it's all about the person. That's what the thing is. And then you feel guilty for like, even, oh, well, why? Well, that doesn't matter, does it? Like, it's just a little thing that's happened. It's like, no, it's all connected to the main grief. It all comes down from this epicenter of like the death. And I thought that's really interesting what you're saying, of like, it can be a starting again, a genesis, because actually that's the thing about life and death, isn't it? Like, when someone does die, it's awful. But if life comes out of that, of a new relationship or new connections, like, that's what reminds us we're all here and we're all the same. And, you know, that's the beauty of it. But to not get that sometimes can be painful as well.
Yeah. You know, off the back of writing this section, I've paid close attention to grief and ways of exploring it. And I've since partnered with a practitioner, Chloe Osborne, and we now run what we call grief labs.
Oh, wow.
But so I realized when I was in the process of writing this section, I was laughing a lot sometimes. Because some of the stories and going over some things or some memories of Big Mommy and stuff was just funny. It was hilarious. But then I felt immediately bad. She's died. Like, why am I laughing? Yeah. She's died. I shouldn't feel this feeling. I should be crying. I should be feeling sad. I should be all of these different things. But not laughing about it. Not cracking jokes and stuff and blah, 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 blah. And then I realized, oh, again, politics of grief. This is really interesting. Like, who's to say that you can't laugh? Who's to say that you can't kind of go through moments of joy and what have you? So I had a conversation with Chloe, and Chloe's an amazing practitioner. And we devised a masterclass where we had all these different things, Play-Doh, and we had all these different kind of like really nifty balloons, messages in like balloons. And you had to partner with someone to pop it. And there's the excitement and there's the nervousness in trying to pop a balloon. And then the excitement when it does go, and then you kind of read it and then you have to write. And we just wanted to provide an environment where people laugh, talk about memories of loved ones, but we don't walk out of it like sobbing. We just want to create an environment where you're able to explore relationships, past relationships with people, and have a more playful experience. So it's called we termed it playing into grief, because it's almost like, how do we utilize forms of play in order to explore grief? And it's something that we're very keen on doing, something that we're very keen on kind of like running workshops on. And it's been a pleasure. It's been an absolute joy in terms of running some of the workshops and seeing people walk out head high. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Being able to talk about situations, but they're laughing about it. There were tears, but it wasn't like absolute like downpours of tears. It was we're talking joyful tears, do you know what I mean, in terms of memory and how that is looked into. So in a way, I never thought that grief would be so high in my agenda or something to kind of explore or talk on. But having gone through that process personally, it's something that I'm very keen to explore, you know, and to speak. So it's been one of those things, like, you know, when there was an invitation to speak with you, I was like, yeah, 100%, let's go for it. Because this is for me the first time that I'm having to actually speak about this in some greater detail. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And I completely relate to it, because that's what I wanted for this podcast. Having experienced grief so deeply myself, I was like thinking of a listener, and I was like, well, I'd want to listen to something that for an hour I did, maybe I got to cry, but maybe I felt heard, but at the end of it, when it stopped, I didn't feel worse than when I started. Feel like I might laugh, I might think, oh yeah, that happened. And there's this thing of, like you said, the guilt, you know, we don't let laughter into grief. I think we're getting better at it, and I certainly am such a huge champion of it, because nothing in life is all one thing. Like, nothing is all sad. And you can be, we accept quite a lot that we can be laughing with our friends and then suddenly feel very sad. Like, no one questions that, but we question crying about someone dying and then laughing. Like, oh no, that's not okay. To mix it there is not okay. Yeah. But actually, we're always mixing emotions and feelings, and it's, nothing is steady, you know, nothing is, this is how you feel, this is how it will be for 2 days, and then you'll feel this. Like, that's just not how grief works. And so much of grief is memories. And if you loved the person and they were a joyful person, of course the memories are going to bring back joy. I'll only weep because they're gone, because you're thinking, oh, and they said that, and that was so funny, and they were so kind. Like, you know, all this stuff comes, and trying to make space for that, holding all of that, I think is how grief gets, not easier, but maybe simpler. If you can do that, you can allow a whole person to be held in your memory, not just, oh, I'm weeping for them, it's awful.
Yeah, and you try to run from it. So in Inside Out is one of my favourite films.
Oh, yeah.
I love Inside Out. It's such a dope film.
It's so good.
And it's almost like you just see his kind of blue self walking around, like waving at you, and just like, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't get too close. Don't get too close. But you actually, you need to be one. You just need to be one with that side, that mood, that emotion, just having that emotion next to you doesn't mean that it's going to be you all day, every day. And, you know, especially speaking from a parent perspective, I'm a father. And, you know, my eldest, he's 8. And if he hears any classical notes, like whether it's a string or anything else like that, or violin or something of that, a solo, like a classical piano, he breaks into tears. Straight. It's been him from like young. He breaks into like, and before, I was like, dude, why are you crying? Why are you always crying? Like, what's the situation?
He's so moved.
So imagine my shock horror when he came to see me at the Royal Festival Hall with the whole 80-piece orchestral with the orchestra, and immediately I was like, oh, you're gonna see dad on stage with like this kind of like really cool orchestra.
Yeah.
And in my head afterwards I was like, oh my god, strings, oh my god. Oh, it's done, it's all done. But he, do you know, of course he cried, of course he broke down, but he was happy. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is just, and you know, there's something in that in relation to masculinity as well, where crying was just something I was told to not do.
Mm.
Especially as a black man as well. Like, it was just something that I was just told, you just have to firm. When I was told that, you know, it's Big Mommy's last days, I was crying on a bus and nobody helped me.
Yeah.
I've seen more people show sympathy for pets and dogs. Nobody on the bus knew what to do.
Oh.
And I immediately felt that whole thing of course you don't know what to do because you're not being programmed to just show care. Because there's already a stereotype as to how this should run and how I should be or how I should be.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, as soon as, like, you know, that window of opportunity that I gave, because I think I was calling out for someone just to ask if I was okay, and when that didn't happen, I just wiped it. I just got back to normal, you know. So to see my boy at 8 crying the way he cries, I was uncomfortable to begin with because of the conditioning that I've gone through over the years.
It's triggering
It was triggering for me to be like, why are you crying when she just suck it up? Why are you crying for? And then I realized that, oh, I'm just looping this. This is just this vicious cycle that I will just be doing exactly what I was told to not do at that age. And at some point, it has to break to a certain degree. Don't get me wrong. The boy cries for, like, the wildest things.
Yeah.
Like, let's not get it twisted. He cries for the wildest things.
Yeah.
But to some degree, I have to know how to balance it on my side or how to unlearn.
Yeah.
I'm unlearning a lot as a father. And it's making me realize just how much I'm unlearning on a day-by-day basis. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it just makes me think about that in terms of crying and how crying can also be something uncomfortable for other people to deal with.
Yeah, what a beautiful place to end on, Yomi, because he sounds amazing. What a lovely little person to be that sensitive to music. My daughter's a bit like that, cries like, and again, I definitely also grew up with a bit of a like, oh, get over it, come on. And I have to kind of, it's all right to cry, it's all right to cry. And especially what you're saying, you know, to be on a bus as a black man and not people just not offering empathy is so sad. And to try and work forward for the future that you're, if that, you know, if your son is ever in that situation, that doesn't happen, that somebody says, oh, you okay? Do you want a tissue? Like, you okay? Because I know how many times I've cried on public transport and people I've had more tissues, even when I've had hay fever, and I'm like, no, it's just, like, I'm all right. You know, I guess as a white woman, they're like, here you go. But for you not to get extended that empathy is, not right. And so to hold space for your son to allow him to cry, especially, you know, when we talk about grief and the future and all the things that children are going to have to go through, I think that's amazing that you're giving him that. Yomi, thank you so much for talking to me about Big Mummy. I love Big Mummy. Just love it. I love it. And I really appreciate you sharing her story and your cousin's story and your story with us. Thank you.
No, thank you for the platform and the opportunity to speak some of this out, because it's very, very rare that I get to talk on it. So thank you for that time.
Yomi's book, Mannerism, is available to buy now. I cannot recommend it enough. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of writing, and you can hear how incredible his poems are from the interview we just had. You can find out more information about Yomi and everything he's doing if you head to his website, yomishode.com. That's YOMISODE.com. You can follow him on Twitter at yomishode as well, YOMISODE. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. It was recorded remotely from mine and Yomi's living rooms. The animation is animated by Alice Loveday, and the artwork is provided by Jade Perkin. I'm sorry. I say it every week, and yet. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.